That's Segundo here, and this is the second part of our Young Roving Correspondent's interview with David Mitchell, or should I say, David Filcher. You see, when I was first hired to introduce this program, the producer thought it would be a funny little joke to have me introduce an interview with David Mitchell. Well, you know, I'm not laughing, because Mitchell is an evil man who established his career by taking my name and portraying me as a frightened DJ at the end of his first novel, Ghostwritten. And now, the producers of this program want to add insult to injury and have me introduce this blackguard again? Well, when I was a young man, we called this kind of thing a hoodwink. Listen to this interview if you like. As for me, I'll be contacting an escort service after I finish up here. At least one of their able ladies might acknowledge me with some kind of credit, or should I say, credit card. Oh dear.
So yeah, we were talking about names and Nixon. I was wondering if, like, Norman Bates, the bus driver, he seemed to remind me very much of Otto, the bus driver from The Simpsons. I don't know if that was a conscious sort of thing. Or...
I haven't met Otto, the bus driver from The Simpsons, but in Ireland, the state broadcaster, RTE, it can only afford about 20 episodes of The Simpsons that it plays in a continuous loop for a few weeks, and then it buys another 20 and plays those in a loop for a few weeks, and it buys another. So that's why I'm not quite the expert on The Simpsons that I wish I was, that I would like to be. But Norman Bates, again, that's it's such an unfeasible coincidence that he has the name of the protagonist of Psycho, of course. It's plausible. Yeah, that's one more of those odd.
So his real name. I didn't know if this was a nickname of the kids or.
It's never made clear, really.
Yeah, I know. I know. I mean, I thought the kids had named him Norman. Yeah, Bates. I thought that, like, specifically Jason had named him.
Yeah. I think it's what they all refer to him as.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, maybe it is ambiguous. Maybe you can read it as it being just Jason's nickname. I don't know, but I quite like the guy. I think most male bus drivers who are ferrying people, adolescent boys, to and from school all over the world, rather like the gym teachers. They are... They're a distinct breed of humanity, and
that's a very kind way of putting it.
and I think it's not implausible that you find the same characteristics all over the world, even in Springfield.
Yeah, it's also like, you know, it also makes me think of, like, Fawlty Towers, which for whatever reason was huge in Germany and Japan, because it's the same kind of archetypes are there. Mm. And I would imagine that, you know, likewise. I mean, you've had Cloud Atlas has been hugely successful here in the United States. I mean, 500,000 copies. You know, I mean, I think it's...
That's probably the... That figure, I think, is maybe the world figure.
Okay.
U.S. is about 90,000.
Oh, okay. That's still... it's still very good, yeah.
Yeah. God bless America. I think one of the Roberts, either Robert Frost or Robert Lowell, said to be truly universal, you must first be local.
Yeah.
And it's the same principle at work, I guess. I'm really surprised and pleased by the reception that Blacks on Green's been enjoying. I really wasn't expecting it. I mean, you guys are supposed to be famous for being supremely indifferent to anything outside your borders.
I thought someone was going to, like, the only negative review I saw was that Stranger one, which was ridiculous, and it said this, it's like, you know, Mr. Mitchell's novel is too easy because everything that has been said about children has already been said in novels. I was like, yeah, well, that's interesting, I guess. Well, everything's already been said about human beings, you know, forget fiction, you know.
You can't please all the people.
Thank you.
My accent fooled you, huh?
But as for the influence of Murakami, I'm going to have to, you know, sort of follow up and see if we could actually get an answer for you on that question.
Oh, I wasn't being evasive. I'm kind of in book tour memory meltdown.
No, I understand. And also, you know, it doesn't help that...
Thank you very much.
The multiple bombardment of questions for me has certainly not helped matters. But, you know, going back to this, the Murakami sort of, you know, obviously he's a huge influence on your work. And was this kind of the urge to strangle the Murakami influence kind of just there while you were writing Black Swan Green? Or did you sort of consciously try to sort of like, I mean, what did you do to sort of like say, okay, I'm David Mitchell, I've got a stylistic voice, but it's got to be David Mitchell, and it's got to be sort of less Murakami inspired than...
It really isn't that calculated. I had a kind of a crush on Murakami a few years back, yeah. And certainly when I was writing Number 9 Dream, I was intoxicated with it,
yeah.
But kind of the hotter the crush, in a way, the more completely you heal yourself,
yeah,
after the crush is over.
Sure.
You know, it's the same with people, of course, and I think it's the same with writers. What I still get when I read Norwegian Wood or if I reread Wind Up Bird Chronicle is sort of what I got when I was reading Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy when I was 10. It's a lust to do to other people what has just been done to me.
Sure.
And yeah, it's I hope it still doesn't look like I'm being evasive, but I'm my own writer and I'm kind of working out my own voice and I don't feel kind of my admiration for Murakami, which is still there.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a sort of a negative thing I have to slough off or fight against or neutralise or combat. We're alive at the same time and we both kind of keep an eye on what we want the reader to be feeling at any one time. He does it very well and I'm still learning, but lots of other writers do this as well, and I don't think we're kind of in a unique subset of two.
Yeah.
I
think, though, what I'm sort of kind of where I'm leading with this question is sort of like, you know, these three other books are very heavy on style, and it seems to me that, you know, the fourth novel, roughly around there for a writer, seems to be kind of that time where you kind of have to either simplify or develop or evolve. It's sort of like, interestingly enough, I talked with Colson Whitehead on a couple days ago,
right,
and he says that he's working on novel number 4, and it's actually, strangely enough, him growing up in the 80s or some, you know, like, you know, that like that sort of thing. But I mean, there seems to me, though, I guess, how did you kind of recognize the sort of make or break point, the sort of like, I've got to develop instead of tossing out the same old thing? I mean, what sort of steps do you sort of do? I mean, particularly with Cloud Atlas, which is given, like, you know, a good deal of praise, likely there are going to be people who are going to have more of a sort of a bullshit sort of idea about it and constantly sort of praise you, as opposed to sort of say, look, you know, David, this is a, you know, a really fantastic book, but, you know, keep in mind that, you know, you've got to also evolve as a writer. I guess, what steps do you take to avoid a situation like that? And do you, I mean, you know, do you sort of ask yourself these questions internally, or...
I try to notice if I'm repeating myself, mm-hmm, if I've written a very, very similar character or situation before.
Yeah.
And I'll strike it out if the answer's yes.
Yeah.
But I think you acquire an omnivoracity of curiosity if you cultivate omnivoracity in reading and living.
Mm-hmm.
To vary your output, vary your input. Allow your curiosity a fairly loose leash. If your curiosity wants to run off in the direction of your 13-year-old self, then, especially if it hasn't done that before, then let it. I think it happens by default if you don't. Just if you don't make one or two fairly easy to avoid mistakes. The chief of which is to think that because Cloud Atlas was reasonably successful, I must be reasonably successful again by doing something rather like it. I mean, that's a mistake, but it's a fairly easy mistake to avoid, isn't it? I mean, it's a fairly obvious one to miss. Because if you don't do that, then you'll just turn into one of these rock groups that never do anything bad, but which quietly disappear as they become less sort of relevant and as they dilute more and more kind of their breakthrough album.
But if you look at like someone like David Foster Wallace, who I think faces this predicament where he has been doing pretty much the same sort of style periodically, a little bit of like, you know, sort of variance in it, but you know, at the same time, there is some sort of like major kind of break that I think he needs to make, that I think you have made with Black Swan Green. And I guess, you know, how this is kind of like a sort of more of a prognostication question, but you know, I mean, I guess how does a writer such as yourself or another writer sort of avoid that sort of corruptible sort of influence? I mean, you know, is there some sort of, I mean, the make or break point, I think, is part of, it seems to me anyway, an inherent part of any writer, you know?
I'm not totally sure if I can kind of answer your question without repeating myself.
Oh, yeah.
You just retain your curiosity. I can only really talk about myself.
Sure, that's fine.
This isn't kind of intended as a remark on David Foster Wallace or anyone else, really. It's just... I'm not interested in writing books that are close to what I've written already. I've proved to myself I can do a book like Cloud Atlas, and why... Well, I'm not motivated enough to kind of spend 3 years writing a book that I've already proved I can write. I'm a lazy person. Only by getting absorbed in something that truly, deeply fascinates me do I kind of get past the point of wanting to do something else and instead wanting passionately to write this book. And I don't have that kind of true, passionate interest in something I've already done. So in a way, at least for me, the problem fixes itself anyway, just by, as I say, avoiding one or two obvious mistakes. The urge to repeat a previous success that anyone can tell you is going to be a diluted version of the previous success. Onwards and upwards, young Ed.
Well, when you say you're a lazy writer, what do you mean by that exactly? Or a lazy person, rather?
I mean, exactly that. I don't clean up the house as often as I can. I've got a bit of a don't leave till today what you can do tomorrow kind of an attitude. In most areas of my life, I'm kind of not one of these people who does all the preparation in advance. I don't have an engineer's mind. I'm a bit messy in many ways. I'm hygienic, but on the other hand, if it's kind of been a week and a half since I cleaned the bathroom and it's looking okay, then I might kind of just leave it another day or two until I feel like doing it a bit more, you know? But the exception's writing, and I damn well love it. I would like to sneak off and leave my wife to take care of the kids all on her own for as long as possible if I could get away with it and if the consequences wouldn't be as bad as they would be. But this is only the case. This kind of lust for writing is only possesses me if it's the book that my curiosity has led me to of its own free will. If it's someone else's curiosity, or if it's been overruled by let's write Cloud Atlas Rides Again, then then I wouldn't care enough, you know. Yeah. But and that's why I wouldn't choose such a book, because I kind of wouldn't even be interested enough to choose it
yeah.
from the kind of array of possible next novels.
This goes back to like the last time we talked. But you noted that you wanted to be overwhelmed by your own imagination as much as possible, and yet you've also sort of gone on record and sounds also here in our conversation that you know you also value sort of stylistic restraints. And I wanted to sort of get a sense of like how imagination and this sort of like sense, this lust for writing that you're describing, how this sort of ties into the sort of the stylistic restraints that you're sort of pining for. I mean, is it kind of, maybe you could describe the relationship between those two.
This isn't exactly what kind of a pen do you use, is it, Ed? let's see. I'm not sure if those two remarks are altogether compatible. I'm not sure if I believe the former as much as I did. But it's okay to change your mind in life, isn't it? We criticise our politicians for not taking exactly the same line that they did in 1985. This means they're spineless. This means they can't be trusted. Rubbish.
Yeah.
World's changing all the time.
Yeah.
I don't trust a politician who does not alter his position, if he's altering it because the world's changed.
Sure.
If he's altering it because he's selling out to the oil companies or something, then that's a different matter. But no. I you should. Everyone should change their mind 8 times before breakfast every day. It would do them a lot of good. Stylistic restraint.
And also what we were talking sort of about imagination versus imagination and stylistic restraint. Okay, so they're not necessarily related, or
not necessarily. Imagination is the ability to see unobvious common elements between two things. A wardrobe and a gate into another world, for example. Stylistic restraint is how you increase the volume of what you're saying by turning the volume down. One is a source, the other is a skill to do. It's a skill of language. I think you can have both. Ursula Le Guin, just to go back to her, because she's the example that springs to mind. Phenomenally imaginative writer, yet there's no flashbang pyrotechnics in her prose. She writes intelligently, quite quietly, without shocks, like an angel. So she can do both.
So for you, anyway, as a writer, it's sort of a matter of not necessarily everything being interconnected, but that you have sort of separate sort of like, I guess, horses running down the, you know, down the field or whatever. I mean, where you've got like literally like 8 or 9 sort of things that are, you know, yes, you could probably, if you're a daring virtuoso cowboy, you can jump from one horse to the other. But I mean, for you, it's not a matter of things being interconnected. It's a matter of things kind of being sort of compartmentalized and separate. You find this to be sort of a way for you to kind of, by keeping them separate, it's a way for you possibly to sort of, I guess, keep yourself organized or keep yourself focused as a writer?
You mean the separate elements of the novel?
I'm talking more about the qualities, like, for example, a quality like, you know, capacious imagination, as well as, you know, what we were talking about, which was... spacing out here, I'm sorry.
That's fine, don't worry.
Stylistic restraints and capacious imagination. We were talking about these two concepts, and you sort of implied to me that, like, you know, they're not really necessarily related. So I'm thinking in terms of, like, if as a writer, do you feel that, you know, concerns of yours to sort of become a better writer, or to develop your voice, that a lot of these little sort of concerns, such as a stylistic restraint or imagination, they should all be kept separately, or how do things operate? I know it's a...
No. It's a good question, and I think the best answer would be a metaphor. They are different components of the same aircraft. So, yes, they're separate. Obviously, they're different things.
Yeah.
Obviously, imagination is a distinct thing for style. There's different words for them, and they're different things. Yet, they are also part of the same process of writing and necessary components for the fiction to take off.
Is that a reasonable answer?
That works. Oh, the thing I wanted to ask you about was conclusions. And with Black Swan Green, I felt that Jason sort of accepts what has happened to his parents a little too sort of neatly. And rather, you know, you could make a point that, you know, this is an unreliable narrator who might actually be sort of like idealizing a situation. And, but I don't know. I mean, at the same time, the end of Cloud Atlas, there's a rather... I mean, maybe it's because of the experience of going through the sort of like, you know, experience of that sort of structure. It kind of leaves one sort of like at the end kind of a little sort of like, oh, it's over. And maybe that was the same case with Black Swan Green. But I guess, how do you feel about your own conclusions? And I mean, do you find this is something that you're still trying to work on as a writer?
I draw them before I write them. Uh-huh. Which is a stupid joke. I draw my conclusions. I'm sorry. Bad pun.
That's fine. Bad puns are welcome here.
Okay. You made one into yourself. So
I know.
Right. It's hard work ending a book. But they need to be unpredictable. They need to be slightly discordant, I think. A predictable... And I think analogy with music works well. The ending of a song is either a crescendo or, even worse, a fade-out. Most satisfying endings of songs for me are kind of slightly discordant. Jung!
Day in the life, yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing that comes to mind. There's a beautiful song by Coldplay called Don't Panic. It is a... I think it's a beautiful song, and that ends in it's the wrong ending, but then afterwards it's kind of right as well. That's kind of what I'm after. Mustn't be predictable, it mustn't be a cliche. Jason accepts what's happened to his parents because he's known all along. It's just he didn't know he knew, and that's an interesting thing about being 13 as well. I mean, this happens when you're older, you know, you can not know that you're in love with someone for quite a while, and then bloody hell, good lord, how did that happen? Didn't see that coming. Well, actually, it had been coming, but you just didn't see it. So that's why I'm not, the last couple of lines were kind of the last lines of Black Swan Green and the last line of Cloud Atlas were kind of gifts that I just felt very grateful for, and it was sort of would have been rude of me to look those gift horses in the mouth and said, well, you know, is this exactly what I'm after? No, I'm not unambiguously kind of totally happy about much in everything I write, but the endings of the two books, I wouldn't change a word, probably. I think about them a lot and think about them deeply, and not to be taken lightly, not to be done lightly. But, it's the ending the book wanted, I felt, and that's got to be, and that has to be good enough for me. And you have to stop writing at some point. You have to let it go at some point.
Yeah.
Like your kids, yeah. Into the big wide world. You have to stop fretting and let them go and hope they'll be okay.
There was something Orson Welles said in the book with Peter Bogdanovich, in the sense that if an artist were allowed to sort of constantly sort of like, you know, have the painting, you know, he would continue working on it until the end of his days.
And in the meantime, the children would starve because there's no money coming in.
Yeah. I will ask one last question, and that is the sort of the Dutch colony off the coast of Japan. Is there anything you could tell beyond the record in this new book?
It'll be a bitch to write, I tell you. Loads of research. God almighty, it's hard. I'm structuring it kind of module by module now. It's six novellas long. The gold standard of historical fiction for me to aim for would be The Leopard by Giuseppe di Lampedusa, and Silence by Endo Shusaku, and The Crimson Petal and the White by Michel Faber. There may well be other historical novels that I don't know about that are as fine or better, but for me, kind of, that's, if you don't try to, and make them kind of, you don't try, Lord help me, if you don't try to make them that good, then kind of don't bother, really. I'm very much involved with it, and I'm walking around with my head in it for big chunks of the day.
Oh, okay.
And it'll take a while. But when it's out, I look forward to seeing you again, Ed.
Yeah, well...
on the Bat Segundo show.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like this is kind of like a sort of almost very, like you're reimagining a world from scratch with this new book. It's almost like a Mervyn Peake sort of situation.
Oh, no, it's a... Would that it were that easy. It's got to be... I'm setting it in a parallel universe, just one universe away, where Earth's history has been exactly the same, everything's exactly the same, except the people on Decima weren't the same as the historical people who were on Decima. This obviously kind of leaves my hands free to be a fiction writer rather than a historian biographer of the real people. So this means I've got to get everything right, and I've got to know how they spoke, wore clothes, ate, thought, had sex, everything. I have to know.
Well, David, it's a pleasure again to chat with you.
You too.
And thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you too.
Definitely.
Leo, it when my heart used to be, hold the earth above me, lay down on the green grass, remember when you loved me, come closer, don't